Hello, hello, and welcome to Mintcast, the podcast by the Linux community for all users of Linux. This is episode 242, recorded live on March 20th, 2016. I am Isaac, and with me on the podcast this week is Rob.
Hey, hey.
There you go, Rob. We record live every other week sometimes, but mostly that's the schedule on Sunday afternoons. Watch the Mintcast website for the schedule. The live stream information is at mintcast.org/livestream, and we are in the Mintcast channel on irc.spotchat.org. If you see something you'd like to hear about on the podcast, head on over to the Mintcast subreddit and let us know. We tried our best to check that, and I think we're getting pretty good. I haven't seen anybody really post anything on there lately, so
it's been pretty quiet over there.
Yeah, I've been noticing that too. So later in the podcast, we're going to be talking all about Void Linux. But right now, let's take a look at some of the recent news from the Linux world.
News you can use from the world of Linux. I'm Bill in Michigan, and I think Mintcast does it all.
Oh, forgot about that bumper intro, but
yeah, my fingers are fumbling something terrible here today. It's daylight savings time. That's what's
yeah. I'm still getting used to it too. I just want to say that if anyone asks me on my next job interview what the highlight of my life or career is, it will be that the fact that I was able to do that intro. That is officially it. Used to it was killing two turkeys with one shot one time when I went hunting, but no longer is that the case. Anyway, on to some Linux Mint news. So, it's been a little while since our last podcast, and since then, Clem has posted on the Linux Mint blog about the hack that took place. And this is taken from the blog. Clem said, quote, "Since Saturday night on February 20th, all our efforts went towards protecting our project and our community. After the despicable attacks on our website and the deliberate attempts at hurting our users, we had to react fast and efficiently. The compromised server was shut down, all ongoing projects were stopped, and all our time, efforts, and resources were used to address the situation." Also, Clem went on to thank some people that assisted in helping and reaching out to help out as well. That some of these people and teams are the PHP BB team, Automatic, which is the company behind WordPress.com, Vast, who helped to analyze the fake ISOs. They were able to produce a full malware analysis and also get updates issued and pushed out to block the servers that were used by the hackers. A couple other people were EUK Host and AYK Solutions. And Clem also wanted to thank all the Mint users for sticking with the Mint team through this and the continuing to support them in their efforts to help correct the problem. So, with all that being said, what were some of the fixes that were put in place to respond to this hack? Well, Clem went on to say that they have put some restrictions up on the servers that were being, which they are using, which might affect some of the websites. So, if you seem to be noticing, if you're doing something legit and you seem to be noticing problems, please reach out to the Mint team. Clem said they will address it accordingly. Almost all the websites now have been moved over to HTTPS, SHA-256 sums, and GPG information are also now available for those who want that information. So that should help out with the ISO verification going forward. And now that should be more transparent that everybody can also see the information as they need be. And they're also considering re-adding the GUFW to the default software selection, which is the firewall. And I have to say that if you ever install Mint, this is usually one of the, in any of those articles you'll read where it's top 10 things to do after installing Linux Mint, whatever version, this is always in there. And I would really like to see that put back in. I think that's a really, really great idea. And then also, besides the post from Clem speaking out about the hack, he also more recently posted some changes that were made to the password policy to the forums and the community websites. And these new rules for passwords consist of a minimum of 10 characters in length. Passwords must now also include upper and lowercase digits and special characters. And I think those are all really, really good rules to enforce. A couple of things that I would really like to have seen put in, and I'm hoping they'll do this going forward, would be automatic expiration of passwords beyond 3 months or a given time period. And then also the ability to not reuse passwords that you have used before. I think those will both be really good going forward. But I personally really like what Clem had to say, and glad he's being transparent about the fixes, and I think they're, it all sounds really positive going forward.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd agree with that on the passwords. I think if you have a good password policy in place, and this is a pretty good one, you know, have to have a certain length of character or a certain length and upper and lower character, that gives you reasonable protection. I think the automatically changing passwords every so often, it's annoying. It just forces people to write the password down on a piece of paper beside the monitor and, you know, other kind of goofy things like that. So I don't know that I'm a big fan of that kind of thing, you know. And the problem is I don't go to the Mint website often enough. You know, I'm going to go there, my password's going to be expired every time. So, you know, it's, I may as well not have one, or I don't know what the deal is there, but passwords, I think, give you a false sense of security. And the real issue, I think, is that if you use the same password everywhere, then, you know, shame on you. You deserve kind of whatever goofy things happen to you. You should just have a unique password that's only used on that site. And then if it gets compromised and you get my password, I don't really care. It's not going to work anywhere else anyway. So,
yeah, that's a good point. I would, I can't remember what their password policies were before this. If they weren't already this case, I would be somewhat depressed. I have a bank that I'm already have emailed and gone back and forth kind of cussing them out because they don't allow special characters, which just blows my mind.
Yeah.
And
or they'll only allow certain ones.
Yeah,
they won't allow all special characters.
Even better,
And it tells you online that you can only use these characters. Okay, so just tell the hackers they don't need to bother checking those. You know, it's faster to crack your passwords now because you told me that. And even, you know, minimum length of 10 characters, it would be better if they didn't do that even, although it doesn't add much, because now I don't have to check any character on any password under 10 characters. I can just start 10 characters and up. Now, that doesn't really save that much time, I guess, because that's pretty quick to check, but...
I can't remember how easy it is. I know with Gmail, I use Ting for my service provider for my cell phones. I have Google Authenticator, the app, working in tandem with that. So if you log in, you have to have my cell phone with that authenticator, which kind of has a very quick, maybe a minute to 30 second long passcode that you have to input. And I don't know how easy it'd be to implement that, but that's always been something. Nowadays, any website or any idea I've had with buddies, we automatically go to that two-factor authentication, and that was one of the key ones to use. What do you think about the other fixes that were put in place or Clem's reaction, Rob?
Well, you know, I didn't pay a huge amount of attention to this whole thing because it was so short, and the little bit that I could see, it really seemed like Clem and the team was responding pretty quickly and pretty publicly to what had happened. And so beyond that, you know, this is just, it's the sort of thing that happens to you on the modern internet. This is going to happen. Moving everybody to HTTPS, that's probably something that they should have done a while ago. And you know, I'm saying this as a person who's looks at a website that doesn't have HTTPS, right? So the Mintcast website doesn't have it. But we're sitting on WordPress, so, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do. The rest of that, you know, the business about MD5s and GPG information, the SHA 256 sums, we've got some listener feedback on this later. You know, I've never really ever looked at those things, and that's just because I'm lazy and sloppy. And so I just download the ISO and away we go. I did, after this happened, I was making an LMDE box, and so I downloaded the ISO, and I thought, oh, yeah, I ought to go look at that. So I did. I went and I looked at the MD5 hash, and I looked at the ISO, or what was on the website, and I looked at what the ISO generated, and they were the same. But it's a huge pain, it's a bit of a pain in the neck to do that, and so I think, I'll bet a lot of people are like me, then don't even check it. You assume that it's okay. And that's the danger with all this stuff, is when you assume it's okay, then you find out, oh, yeah, actually, it's not okay. And you know, there's a problem. And I would have been caught had I happened to download at the wrong time. So I think they're all things, you know, and so let me back up a minute. You know, what do I think about these things that they did? The truth is I'm not enough of a security expert to know whether these are the right things to do or not. They all look like really sensible, plausible things to do. They're the kind of things I see other websites talking about that they've done. So, you know, I think it's likely that they got good advice from security people who looked at their stuff and said, oh, yeah, you really should do this, you really should do that, which is not all that surprising, really, that they would find stuff that could be done. I think that that's always going to be the case. It looks like the Mint team took a bunch of good advice and made some changes, and it's probably not everything that they need to do. I certainly don't know anything else they need to do, but there's probably other things that they could do, and I expect that, you know, given the kind of thing I've seen out of them in the past in terms of responding to things like this, I think as they are able to identify things that they need to do, they'll do it. Maybe it's been a bit of a wake-up call that, you know, it's gotten to be a big enough target that somebody was willing to invest a bunch of time and effort into causing trouble. So it's probably time that they're going to have to pay closer attention to it. It's unfortunate, but, you know, nothing that happened or that I heard about said that they behaved inappropriately or were irresponsible in what they were doing, although I know that that has been, that's a charge that's been leveled at them, that they're been irresponsible. I think there's always going to be haters that want to get in there and stir the pot and accuse you of things. And I think they're probably doing well. I'm not going to stop using Linux Mint because of it. I'm not going to suggest that other people stop using it. I think it's a good distro, and I think that they're learning fast and will do what's appropriate.
Yeah, I think that was really well put. I mean, there's always going to be, I think these are all good steps in the right direction. People can always say this isn't enough, but I think this is all in the right direction. And building on the attitude that as Linux in general are both, especially Linux gets bigger, hackers are going to take more of a shot at that. And then segue into our next news article kind of builds on this attitude of how big Linux has actually gotten. So
it's just turning into a big deal, this Linux thing we do.
I know. So you think people are actually using it or something. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So this past month, Microsoft announced some new features that they would be implementing for SQL Server 2016. And then in a brief, small side note, they also announced that they would be bringing SQL Server to Linux as well. Now, before anyone gets way too excited, the target time/day for the availability for this will be probably around mid-2017, which I figure will be the end of 2017. That's usually how all software releases go. I've used SQL Server before at several jobs. I have never seen anything that much that really makes SQL Server ahead of any other relational databases. Me personally, I feel that NoSQL is the way to go, but that's an argument for another day. One thing that does make me feel a little WTF is, I believe you say Scott Guthrie, the Microsoft spokesperson in the article, says SQL Server for Linux will also bring to the Linux users features such as mission-critical performance, industry-leading total cost of ownership, security, and hybrid cloud innovations.
Well, those are all brand new things that Linux doesn't do now. Yeah,
that's exactly what I was thinking. Like, you could not get more buzzword. I'm looking for synergy and deep data are the only other words they're missing.
Bingo. Or,
yeah, metal as a service. But we'll get to that guy in a few minutes. But industry leading total cost of ownership, really, folks. But anyways,
perfect. Yes,
I feel this is really honestly a big step though for Microsoft, because one, the announcement alone says that they're serious about working with Linux now. Whether or not that's with all the distros and creating their own, you know, who knows. But they are definitely serious about working with Linux. And the reason for this would be, why they're so serious is my second point, which is they really need to get to a market that they have never touched before. And that is exactly what Linux offers them. So the more they work with Linux, the more you, me, Rob, and all of our listeners have to deal with them. So Say you're at work and your work is a Linux shop through and through. Well, now if for some reason your DB implementation isn't getting the job done or isn't working correctly, SQL Server is honestly a viable alternative now. Even if you and you don't want to work with it or you've never used it, someone now at work could be, well, we could use SQL Server.
And we could use Microsoft. They're really good.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, he's honestly correct. I mean, that is something you have to, like, bring into the equation now. So,
yeah.
But I believe, Rob, you made a prediction.
I did. I was going to bring that up. That's why I put this second quote in here from my good friend, Mr. Shuttleworth, who said, we are delighted to be working with Microsoft as it brings SQL Server to Linux. There you go. You heard it here first on the Mintcast way back there in that episode in January. Canonical and Microsoft.
Yeah.
They're doing it together.
I am glad to see at least Canonical is in the mix to get this accomplished. Got somewhat. I do trust them more than Microsoft, but I feel that this is now the way of the world. Microsoft understands that you can no longer hang out in a Microsoft enclosed environment. People are like using services from each other to get the job done. Everybody's a hodgepodge mix now in all their workshops. But I feel for sure both Ubuntu and, or Canonical, I should say, and Microsoft must form, not a partnership, but must work together if they're going to get any foothold in the cloud environment, which what everybody's doing, which is completely owned by Amazon. And then what isn't owned by Amazon is owned by Google. So,
yeah. You know, we look at these and we carry news stories like this often because, you know, you look at somebody like Microsoft saying, oh, yeah, we're going to release our products on Linux. And we have spent so long, hollering at Microsoft as being the evil empire that then they come along and say, oh, we're going to put our stuff on Linux. And so the danger is that we look at this and say, oh, yeah, Linux has finally arrived. You know, the Microsoft's finally noticing. And that's actually completely wrong because Linux is already the dominant server operating system on the internet. The fact that Microsoft's bringing SQL Server there is like a, well, duh, of course. You know, really? You're going to give up the biggest market in the world and not have your product run there? So in a sense, this is Microsoft waking up and saying, oh, this Linux thing, yeah, we're going to have to pay attention to this if we're going to transition ourselves into a cloud organization, which is what they're in the process of doing. So that, I think that's what this is as much as anything, is that they're saying, yeah, of course we have to be on Linux. That's where everybody else is, you know. It's just natural that we would be there, so.
Yeah, I definitely think, I completely agree. Microsoft has finally caught on to the attitude that people are just going to use their tool. They might use their tools, but they're going to use other tools with them, and they just,
yep.
I mean, that's just the way of the world, and I kind of like it. At least they're open-minded now. It's a little bit better. So hopefully in the future we'll see other, who knows what they'll release next. It gets more surprising every day. But I'm hoping they will fix Skype because it is a mess on Linux. But
yeah, it's a mess on Linux. It's kind of it's a mess everywhere. I'm really not happy with Skype these days, and I use Skype actually a lot because that's how I talk to my mom. And it's nice and easy for us to use, but it has all kinds of weird flaky kind of behavior that, is just really annoying. So it'd be nice if Microsoft would make it kind of the nice, reliable, easy to use thing that Word and Excel and the rest of them are that, you know, they could fix that. I don't know whether they will or not, but it'd be nice to see if they would do it.
Yeah, Cortana might be coming to Linux.
yeah, I suppose there's always that possibility. I don't know whether that might not be a good thing. So, yeah. So a couple of quick odds and ends to move us through to the end of the news here. One of them is Proton Mail. And so this is something... I don't know if I had mentioned this before ever on the podcast or not, but back when we were looking at mail encryption and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I was doing roaming around on the internet and looking at stuff, and I came across this Proton Mail thing. And it was a closed beta, I think, at the time that I was, or by invitation beta at the time. And so I sent them in a request, and it was, gosh, I don't know how long it was that I had to wait. But eventually they came back and said, okay, you know, we've got down to your name in there. And so I get in, and it's an encrypted email service. It's a European startup. It's the servers are in Switzerland, it provides end-to-end encryption. So the way that I had been using it was on their website. So there's no client. So you log into their website and you log in with your username and password, and then you log in you give it another password to unencrypt your mailbox. So it's kind of doubly encrypted. Well, that's not really right. But your mailbox sitting on their server is encrypted, so they can't read your mail either. And then anybody that you send, another Proton Mail user, if you send email to them, it all just stays within that encrypted environment. And so they can't see it. Nobody can get at it. They can't divulge the emails to anybody. You know, it's completely locked in. If you want to send an email to somebody outside of Proton Mail, then they have this way that you can send them an encrypted email, and they get an email from you saying that, or get an email saying that you've sent them an encrypted email, and go on their website, and there's a password that you give them that they can then decrypt it. So you can even talk to people outside. So the long and the short of it is that it's out of beta now, and so it's open to everybody. You can just go over to protonmail.com and sign up, and they also have released an Android and an iOS app, which they didn't have before. And so I have, I just came across this week because they just opened it up this week. And so I went and downloaded the Android app and tried it, and yep, it works. But I haven't really done very much with it. But it seemed like a really good idea that if they could get this to just get to be more common, or get this approach to be standardized and more common, or something, that it's the kind of thing that would make using encrypted email a little bit cleaner a little bit easier, because it's just complicated right now. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what I'm trying to put it into the IRC here, that URL, and it just really doesn't like that URL for some reason. But anyway, https://protonmail.com is where they are. So anyway, that's an interesting. And so I noticed you tried it.
Yeah. I saw the link to it in the show notes, and then I'm glad you brought that up to me, honestly, because here recently I was wanting to get another email account, but I just didn't want to go to Gmail again.
Yeah.
And I saw what you posted, and then I went and downloaded the app on Android and created it really quick. And then I sent you a test email.
Right, which I got.
Okay. And that should be set to expire forever, apparently, in about an hour or so. That's why I set it up for, hopefully it would do that during this little time period here. I think it should be doing it right about now, if I'm correct. But
okay.
Or at least another, if not now, another hour. But yeah, I like it. I thought it was really, really slick. And then I went on their website and saw their buy-in options. And you can get a lot for not much at all, a whole lot more accounts for pretty dirt cheap. But I like it. I think I'm going to start using more often.
Yeah, I have their just a free account. And to be honest, haven't used it very much, because it was really most useful for other Proton Mail users. That's where it's really the most useful, because otherwise you have to kind of do this little dance about, you know, encrypting it and sending them a key and kind of all that stuff. But it's a nice idea, and more than anything else, I like the idea. So that's what I was after. So the other quick hit that I wanted to touch on that leads us sort of into our main topic here is one that's called How to Install or Upgrade Your Linux Kernel or to Linux Kernel 4.4.5 in Ubuntu and Linux Mint systems. And this I find to be just a fascinating article. Now, it's not profound and earth-shattering, that sort of stuff, but it's also not the kind of thing that Ubuntu users are typically looking to do. I tend to sit like I'm sitting on an Ubuntu system or on a Mint 17.3 system, and so I'm running 3.19.0, mm-hmm. right? So that's the kernel I'm using. The 4.4.5 kernel is the recent one, right? There's ones after that probably even. I don't know what the one that we're going to look at in a minute is running on right now. But anyway, so he goes through the instructions of how to get the kernel from the kernel PPA at Ubuntu.com. There's a way to download them, install the kernel headers, reboot your system, and boom, then you're running the latest and greatest kernel. And so... interesting. I don't know about. So, is this a good idea? Is the question? Yeah, and so Bill Hamai comes out. Yeah, lots of Clem's dislike of updating kernels is another thing that'll come back to haunt him. Yeah, it's not an obvious thing that you should update the kernel. It's not an obvious thing that you should not either. I'll hasten to say that. They release they release kernels and they fix bugs and they close security holes and they, it's a living piece of software just like every other living piece of software is. And 3.19, heavens, I don't know when that was released. It was like forever ago that was released. My Mint 13 box, the studio box, is 3.2.0-38, so that's even older. So these are old kernels, anyway, is my point. And a lot has changed in that length of time. And so with change comes, well, change. Some stuff that used to work doesn't work anymore. Some stuff that didn't used to work now works flawlessly. So, I think you got to be a little bit judicious about this. And maybe you could argue that the Mint guys have been overly cautious. They have a kernel. It's easier now to update to a newer kernel. But even the newer recommended kernels, the newest recommended kernel is still old in kernel time. So,
yep.
I don't know. Are you a new kernel guy, or are you just let me run whatever thing I've been running forever?
Originally, I was just let me run whatever. But now as I play with more and more distros, I'm starting to... I'm going to try this out, honestly, when we get done with the podcast, and then get mad when I destroy my laptop. But
yeah, do it on a machine that you don't need for work.
But I recently put Manjaro on this exact same laptop as well, and it was using 4.3 or 4.2, I can't remember, and everything worked great out of the box. I don't see why it wouldn't work great with Mint, but... I was going to try it before the podcast, and I was like, yeah, I better not do that.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
just in
not
case.
On the...
But
yeah, that's the cardinal rule of podcasting is you don't update the operating system on the machine you're going to do the podcast on right before the podcast.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that in the beginning I didn't really care too much about, probably because I wasn't wiser. And now that I learn more and more, I definitely want to upgrade it just to see what it'll do. And if it works out great, that would be awesome. I can know it would set a new benchmark for what I know I can use. Rather than, say, with the next, like, Linux Mint 18 is using a 3.40 or whatever the heck number, then I can know at least 4.4.5 here. If it works great, I know I can benchmark at that point and keep going there forward.
Yeah, and I don't know what they'll do on 1604, on Ubuntu 1604 when it comes out. I'm not sure which kernel they'll go to. They've tended to go to something... close-ish, but not brand new mm-hmm. on the LTSs. So, I don't know. So, if what you want is to run this latest and greatest kernel, have we got an idea for you? And that kind of, that's my transition. How's that?
That's nice. I liked it. I liked it. It was nice.
You liked it? Okay, I'm going to transition the real way.
All right, Rob. A couple weeks ago, you fell in love with Void Linux. Let's hear about this one and how you took me down this path that I'm still kind of can't believe I went down. Let's hear it.
We're still digging our way out of this. This has been one of those, in hindsight, why didn't I just say, that's interesting, and move on? Why did I stop and look at that car wreck? Or why did I stop and look at what those two guys with the masks were doing in that store? Why did I do that? There are some things you just shouldn't do. But anyway, so cast your mind back, if you will, a couple of episodes to Mintcast 240, Fixing Linux. We mentioned in there a site called troubleshooters.com, the troubleshooters.com Linux library. And it's really a pretty good resource for, looking for bits and pieces of things that you could use to fix your Linux system, which is what we were talking about. Anyway, on there, they have a guide on using Void Linux. And I looked at it and I thought, Void Linux, what's that? Let me look at that. And then, so never stopping to think, why would they think that they had to have a guide on troubleshooters.com for how to use? There was no guide on how to use Linux Mint on troubleshooters.com. So that should have been my first notice. Anyway, in the guide, they say, Void is a wonderful distro with lousy documentation. Some docs don't tell you what program to run on the live CD to install. Other docs make it seem like your only choice is doing a chroot install. This is usually not true. But that statement is actually true. Their commentary on what was there and what was not there and what some of the documentation says and what it doesn't is right on the money, because as we found out even today, as we're trying to look at things, the documentation on Void Linux is not real cool, real straightforward. Anyway, their guide is really good, and so we're going to take a look at Void Linux today. Okay, so what exactly is Void Linux? Well, you go over to their website, which is at voidlinux.eu, www.voidlinux.eu, and you learn Void Linux is an independent distribution developed entirely by volunteers. Unlike trillions of other existing distros, Void is not a modification of an existing distribution. Void's package manager and build system have been written from scratch.
I'd like to say really quick that any distro that attempts to go down this route of creating everything from scratch, mad props to them. Even if it doesn't work, at least they took that shot. And I will always give up, congrats and props to anybody that does that.
Yeah, this really is a unique distribution in that respect, I think. Well, it's probably not unique, but it's a novel distribution in that respect. They have really done a bunch of this from scratch, so it's not a derivative distro. It's developed by somebody named, on the internet, as far as I can see, goes by Juan RP. On GitHub, he's XTRAEME, Extreme. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and there's half dozen or so or dozen contributors listed on GitHub where all of the source for Void Linux is. It's available with Enlightenment, Cinnamon, LXDE, LXQT, Mate, or XFCE, and it supports x86, 8664, the BeagleBone, BeagleBone Black, QBBoard 2, Odroid, U2 and U3, Raspberry Pi, the Raspberry Pi 2, and USB Armory. So it supports a staggering array of desktop environments and a staggering array of hardware. So it's really an interesting little doodad from that respect. It is built on its own stuff. It literally is not built on top of anything else. Oh yeah, I forgot I can't log into it. which I'll come to in a minute here. So they build it up from scratch, which makes it so that opens up a lot of concerns, right? Because we've talked about this with Linux Mint. Keeping a distro running and keeping it going is a lot of work. And that's true for Mint, where they really are, it's a derivative of Ubuntu. And so a lot of the upstream stuff they don't have to do. The Void guys are trying to do it all. So that's a fairly big task. And the package manager is also its own thing, also written by 1RP. So I think that's where it actually started. He wrote a package manager, and then he thought, hey, I can write a whole distro around this. Okay, so let me walk you through kind of what I did in looking at this Void Linux and kind of where we got to. So I had a Mint 17.2 laptop, ThinkPad, Lenovo ThinkPad X230, and I was going to replace the hard drive in it with an SSD. So I thought, okay, perfect. This is a great time to do this. So I pulled the old drive out, popped in the SSD, download the ISO, and didn't check the MD5 or anything because it's just an ISO. You know, come on, what could go wrong? So I downloaded it and used the image. I used the Linux Mint USB image writer to create a bootable USB. We've talked about this before, and I know this is not a unique and earth-shattering tool, but I love this little thing. Take an ISO, just puts it on a USB, and it's just really easy. boot it up. So it boots up no problem, comes up into a Cinnamon desktop, and then I'm looking around at it, and it's like it's a desktop. So normally what I'm expecting is there's a CD sitting there, or the image of a CD sitting on there, or something sitting on the desktop that says, click me, you know, install it. Nope, can't find anything there. So, and this is indicative. And so the good news is no issues. It comes up. Didn't ask any hard questions. Just boots up into the desktop and works. So I get over onto the Void Wiki looking for, well, how do I install this thing? And it says, oh, log into a character console as root and run void-installer. Oh, okay. So I come over there and look in the, and I'm thinking, okay, well, how do I, okay, well, so Control-Alt-F1, now there's some gibberish on the screen, Control-Alt-F2, Control-Alt-F3, I find an empty console, plain vanilla, I could have SU'd in a console in the desktop environment, but I thought, I don't know whether I want to do that or not. So I got a clean console open, log in as root, and run Void installer. Really old-fashioned, very Spartan, I should say. Character-based installer. And it looked like Ubuntu looked, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe longer than that ago, or the old Debian installer kind of looked like this. Character-based, you had to go run through, you know, there's all these questions that ask you at the beginning about what kind of, you know, what locale do you want to use, and what keyboard of the list of 10,000 do you have, and, you know, which of the Linux-named time zones do you want to be in, and kind of all sorts of stuff that modern installers I've gotten quite spoiled with either don't ask you, they figure it out from where you are, or they guess at what you've got, and they're mostly always right. Anyway, reasonably good directions on their wiki, much better directions on troubleshooter.com. But in any case, I got it installed and got it running. And I had forgotten in here, I ran into another problem right at this point. And I'll let Isaac talk about that in just a minute when I came back in to log in. But because I wanted to talk a little bit about what you got installed and what you're using. So it uses a package manager called XBPS that is described on the Void Linux website. It was written by the same guy that creates, or the creator maintainer of Void. So that's why I say I think he did XBPS first. And it's, I don't know, it looks like, I think we put, if you go back and look at the our episode 240, I think there's a link in there to a translation key that's up on DistroWatch that they've got for these installers. So it does all of the same kinds of things that apt-get does, and Pacman and Yum and the whole bunch of them. They all do the same thing. But in any case, it uses XBPS. When you install Void Linux, you get just Linux and the desktop. You get nothing. It's there's very little in there. It did have kernel 4.2.6-1 and Cinnamon 2.8.3. So fairly recent kernel, fairly recent updates. You do an update by typing in sudo xbps-install space dash capital S lowercase u, which is obvious once you look it up on the web, on their website. And it happily updates your system for you. That's the command update system. I had to do it twice, as is common with the Mint updater as well. The first time it ran, it updated XBPS itself. Then you run it again, and then it updates everything else. And it updates to kernel 4.4.5_1 and Cinnamon 2.8.7, which are current releases. I also went in and installed LibreOffice 5.1.0.3 with no issues at all. So that kind of is where I got to in looking at this. And then I got looking around for, okay, well, let me look at other software. And it dawned on me that what you have as a package, as a software manager, really is XBPS. That's it. And I was struck by how spoiled I have gotten on modern distros that seem to all have a software manager, a GUI software manager, so that I can just go in and say, oh, yeah, I want to install that thing. What's it called? Oh, it's VLC. Yeah, I want VLC. Find me the VLC. And it gives me a list of 25 things. The top one is probably the VLC thing, and I click on it and say, yeah, install that. In here, it is possible to do all that stuff. So you can install these things. There's thousands of packages in their repos. So it's not that there's a lack of software in the repos. It's just considerably more fiddly to figure out what the name of the package is that you want to install. It's not impossible to do, and it's not even really all that hard to do. It's just really different. For one thing, you're doing it in a character console, and you're doing it by issuing XBPS commands. It's like trying to install LibreOffice or install Firefox or something only using apt-get. Well, first you have to go find out what the name of the package is that you need to install, and then you have to remember what the command was to install something. And it's just, it's more complicated than what I think most Linux people even are willing to do. And certainly, well, I was going to say it's more complicated than Windows, but probably isn't. It's probably less complicated than Windows because you're not having to search around all over the internet to find some random website that offers something that it claims is the thing you're looking for, but in fact is some malware. So you don't have that problem. You're at least looking in the repos, and there are ways to look, to search in the repos to find stuff, and so it's better that way. So we're getting ready to do the podcast today, and I go to boot up that machine, and it kernel panics. I was like, what? I didn't do anything. All I did was, the last thing I did was an SU right before I ran it last time, and oh, never mind. This is exactly what I'm talking about. I don't know whether it was me that did something wrong. I don't know whether... I don't know what it was. I don't know whether the kernel update or the last update I did broke something that, I don't know. There's a bunch of stuff. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's a more primitive distro now. Mm-hmm. So why is that? Well, it's because it's, you know, half a dozen people managing the thing in their spare time, and this is a huge undertaking. Managing one of these, a major distro these days, is a lot of work. It really is an enormous amount of work, and so kudos to them for building something from scratch that's not just another, oh, I changed the theme in Cinnamon and made my own distro. This is not that. This is a built from scratch distro that gives you a lot more control, I think, over what you get. But it's just, I don't know that they've got the horsepower to actually do it and make it work. So that's kind of my read on it. I went back and reinstalled it back into the VM again, and it's ready for me to log in now. Except, of course, during the installation, it asks you for a root password, but it never has you create a user other than root. When it boots up into the GUI and you log in, it won't let you log in as root.
Yep.
It didn't make root a loginable user from the GUI anyway.
You have to root into root.
So you got to root into root and create a pseudo root, and you root your pseudo root, and then you don't. It's everything that is just annoying about Linux.
It's the super user seed.
Right, or something. Anyway, so that's my read on, and so I got stalled there. So, Isaac, as you're talking about what your experience is, I'm going to go create my user so I can log into that box.
Okay, so I was originally going to play with Void Linux on the Raspberry Pi or the BeagleBone Black, because I have one of those as well, but I didn't really get around to it, and I might still give that a go, you know, a shot. But anyway, so I download Void Linux Cinnamon Edition on SD card and use that to boot into really fast download times for the ISO, and equally really fast boot up times. I was pretty pleased about that. I noticed a bug with the terminal that had certain characters overlaying on top of the next one, and it only happens with the letter M. And I went through all the different font selections in the terminal and could not get that to stop doing it. And now I happened to notice this also, I think it was last week as well, because I've been playing around with Antergos, however you say that distro, and I noticed that their terminal was doing it the same. And also,
it's the font. I had the same problem.
I couldn't find the right font setting. So I used Lubuntu on my Raspberry Pis, and I was able to make the font do it on there, but they had a set, you know, the correct font selection to get it back to the readable format. But either way, I just suffered through it, went on through. It wasn't really too bad. And so I noticed, you know, like Rob was saying, the kernel version when he first pulled down, I believe it was 4.2, which is not really good. Shows, you know, they were up to date. I was pleased about that. And during the course of using the distro originally, before I went down any of the installer route, I just was reminded how much I really like Cinnamon for a desktop environment. Now, I'm a huge fan of LXDE and Mate quite a bit, but there is just something about Cinnamon that I like more than the rest. And I'm pretty sure it has to do with the hotkeys, because I know them by default, and also the fact that I'm addicted to a searchable menu now. So that was something I didn't really care about, and then slowly as I start using it more and more, I find myself not being able to get away from it. And when I can't use it, I'm a little, not perturbed, but just, I'm like, all right, whatever. But so anyway, I go through the installer process, and like Rob was saying, it's really simplistic. Now, before this, I took the time on my current laptop to go ahead and use Gparted to, you know, rip off a partition, and I was going to put it right on there. And I was able to install it, you know, on my laptop along with Mint. And I booted up, and like Rob's saying, I go to log in, and I'm not able to log in as root, even though I just set the password to root on the installer. So during the installer process, you're not asked to ever create a user. It's just simply, hey, what do you want the root password to be? And you just set it, you know, okay, move along. So I do this, and when I boot it back up, after the install process, I can log in as root. I use the SD card on another laptop to see, well, who is the current user? Well, it's Aon. And I'm like, okay.
A-N-O-N.
Yeah, yes. I don't know where he came from or whoever this person is. And I try that on, you know, can't log in as him either. I can't log in as myself. I can't log in as anything. So then I go back to the wiki and read it over, and they say, oh, by the way, you have to create a user, add them to a bunch of groups that I feel like that are unique to Void Linux. And so, typical me being me, and I guess also a male who doesn't read or follow directions ever, I only do that first part. So then I want to start updating stuff. Well, I can't sudo because Isaac's not been added to the sudoers list.
Sudoers list, of course not.
So I'm playing this back and forth game with the virtual console to go log in as root because I can't sudo into su because I'm not allowed to do that either. So I'm playing this back and forth game to add users, to add me to this list, so I can because only through the virtual console can I log in as root. And I was able to finally get that all up and running. And I noticed that my Wi-Fi card, I don't know if it's just because it's Broadcom and all its awesomeness, wasn't picked up by Void Linux. But I noticed that the Wi-Fi card was never picked up, regardless, even after I got the stuff updated. And there was something else that hit me right then I was going to mention, just went blank on it with that. But there's also not a device driver section that I have become accustomed to in Mint, where I could see if it was picking up on the driver or not, and hopefully maybe, disable or enable it. They don't have that selection as well. Now, I have noticed myself, as I play with more distros, I'm starting to appreciate what Void Linux did do, which you brought up somewhat, Rob, and I added to that they don't, it's very simplistic and slimmed down version of what the installer brings to the table. I love LibreOffice and stuff. Sometimes I don't need it, sometimes I do, but there's stuff I'm noticing on, especially now whenever I pull down a new version of Mint or Lubuntu or Ubuntu Mate, I believe there's several de facto frameworks that come with it that I automatically uninstall because I've never used them and I never will use them. Mainly it's, I think, Pigeon, Instant Messenger's one, and then Thunderbird's another. And I do kind of like that Void Linux, I'm starting to get more used to a slimmed down distro and taking away things I don't need that I won't ever use. I love that about all most Linux distros that I use. So I do like that Void Linux did do that. All in all, though, I think without the wiki, you're completely right, Rob. There's no way I would have been able to got any of the installing done. But once it was installed, that's what I was going to bring up earlier, was whenever I updated Grub appears and says there's an unknown distribution of Linux on whatever partition I'd put it on. So I thought that was kind of funny, but it booted up just fine, and I was able to take off. Once I learned the ins and outs of, I really wish they would allow me to set a default user during the install. Had they done that, I would have been a bigger fan of this distro. Now, this is a distro I definitely would not push off on anybody if they're like, hey, what should I use? This is definitely, I wouldn't say for the beginners, but definitely for a more intermediate user to advanced. Because even if once you get installed, like you said, Rob, it doesn't come with everything you might want to use. And I'm a fan of installing through the command line, but that, like you said, you do need the internet when doing that because it's a little bit of a hunt for what you're looking for exactly. And as I've used more, as I use Manjaro more, I've noticed that's whenever I go to, oh, well, hey, where's Chrome or Chromium? I get about 1,000 different options for what I want, and I have to go through and kind of pick which one through the command line. But I definitely would not recommend this distro to anyone who's just starting to get into Linux or thinking about Linux. But if you're looking for something different and you know your way around a Linux box pretty well, I would recommend giving it a try, seeing what it is, because like Rob said, the XBPS, I believe, is their package manager. That's really that's quite an undertaking they did to create that from scratch, so props to them for doing that. And I'm definitely going to check in on this distro in the future. Whether or not I use it more is still to be seen, but I definitely will keep tabs on them to see how they're coming along.
I have to agree, I wouldn't recommend this to somebody unless what they're interested in was a really small, lightweight distro and one that kind of was more Linuxy than it was. You have to be real, real comfortable in the command line. You have to, any distro that requires you to add new users from the command line before you can log in for the first time, You know, that's a pretty high bar to set for most people to get using it. So, yeah, I expect that my Void Linux is not going to survive the afternoon. I probably won't be back to it. And that says more about me than it does about Void Linux, to be honest. You know, it's just not the Linux experience that I'm really very interested in, and hence it's why I use Linux Mint, is because that's much closer to what I'm looking for. So, you know, the nice thing is that it's a rolling release. And so you're only going to install it once, and you just update it with the updater, and you get the latest kernel when it comes out. The bad news is that you get the latest of everything, and so if stuff breaks, you're going to have to be able to and be willing to tinker with it to fix it. So, you know, if you're interested in, if you're a distro spelunker, like I know some of our listeners are, by all means, jump in there and give it a try. But if you're using Linux because you just like Linux and you like to get stuff done, this is probably not worth time to go, certainly not to install on real hardware and try and use. It's just too many headaches, I think. So that's my read on it.
Yeah, I have currently too many distros on my plate to play with and try and goof around with it to make this one. But like I said, I will keep up with them in the future and wish them the best of luck. It's a pretty good distro, and hopefully they'll get the kinks ironed out and get it going forward.
Well, and, you know, the other thing that's probably an observation that we would be remiss if we didn't make is that this kind of distro is exactly the kind of thing that makes Linux such an interesting ecosystem to live and work in. Is that there are people who are out there doing things like this. And so Void Linux didn't scratch an itch that I have, and so I'm saying what are basically negative things about it. But it could easily have been that this was just a home run. You know, the problem is that before somebody tries some clever new thing, you don't know whether their clever new thing they were going to try is going to be the thing that just changes the world, or whether it's going to be, meh, well, whatever. And the fact that you can do it is really the remarkable thing, I think, about Linux. So the fact that this guy could go out and create Void Linux, and it'd be so different from all the rest of the stuff that we use, and succeed and stand a website up, and he just decided, nobody said that he could do this, he just did it. That is one of the real fundamental strengths of Linux, I think, and of open source generally. So yeah. I want to echo what you said right at the beginning, guys. Kudo to the guys that put Linux or Void Linux together, because I think, you know, this is the spirit of open source that is so valuable to us, I think.
Yeah, two more things before we get off this topic. I just want to say that this distro, I've already been really interested in Linux from scratch in this distro because of what they did with the package manager has increased that interest for me to get more into that. And two is I'm going to create the Void Linux podcast and get ahead of the curve. So
there you go. Yep. Okay, well, I'll subscribe, man.
You
got my attention. All right. All right. Well, there were crickets last time on our user feedback, and so we got an email this past 2 or 3 weeks from James Eaton, who we haven't heard from in a long time. James has been a listener for quite a while, Banana Bob, and so I hadn't heard from him for a while. So this was cool that we got some feedback from him. He says, yes, guys, I'm still here. The rumors of my demise are much exaggerated. Two things for you to chew over. The first is I was directly affected by the Mint hack. I downloaded the compromised ISO, but did not install because I checked the MD5 some. I thought, this is funny why they're different. And so he says, it was late, so I just went to bed. The next day, I read the post that Clem made about the attack. Close call? Well, not really. I did the right thing and checked the MD5 some. If others who downloaded the ISO had done the same thing, they would not have installed. Or would they? The second is that I have two Linux books that sit on my shelf. They were recommended to me by a podcast many years ago. They are Linux in a Nutshell and LPI Linux Certification in a Nutshell. Like Rob, I find that all my questions are answered by Google these days, but I did learn a bit from the books. I must tackle the LPI book again now that I have more experience in the operating system. Thanks for the command line hotkey website. I hope to use some of the tips in the future. No crickets in the mailbox this week. Cheers, James Banana Bob. So that was good to get notes in from him. We also got some pokes and jabs and stuff on not really knowing what was going on with the Mint hack, and we waffled around a little bit, which is all fair enough.
I'll take all the blame for that one, because
I don't think there's blame.
What I was going to say is that I listened to way too many podcasts, and I'd heard all week long and the week before that people going off about the Linux Mint hack. So when it was our turn to do it, I was so just fed up with it that I was like, I don't want to give this time of day. And I don't even talk about this hacker. He's a moron. He's a loser. I don't want to give him any more time, 15 seconds of fame more. So yeah, definitely apologize to the listeners for that one. I've since then laid off my Linux podcast till after we do our show, and then I listen to them all after that. I got an email, and I'm having a hard time logging in, but we did get an email. I can't think of his name now. It's a listener from the Falls Church area, which is near me. And super apologize that I do not remember your name, but I will give a shout out to him on the next podcast. He's been listening to our stuff, and he's been wanting to get in touch about how to get some more Linux stuff going on in the area. So appreciate the emails from the unknown person. I can't remember.
Unknown person whose email I remember reading, but now can't remember because I can't. You're sounding like me. You're not old enough to sound that mixed up. Yeah.
Going back to James' email, you brought up a good point, Rob, which is even if you check the sums like he did, it's human nature to be, oh, well, maybe I did something wrong.
I must have done something. It's probably okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. I don't know. It's just that attitude of sometimes it's, is it me, them, whatever. And especially if it's late, then that's one other thing. But yeah, I mean, he saw the difference, was like, oh, who knows? Well, maybe it's me. I mean, no fault to him. I would have done the exact same thing.
So that actually what he ended up doing, and he kind of puts it down, I think, a little bit to just, oh, well, I don't know what's going on. And he went to bed. But what he actually did was actually a pretty smart thing. So you download something and the MD5s don't match, or you notice anything else that's weird about it. What should you do? Well, maybe nothing. Maybe just say, okay, I'm just going to stop and let me wait 24 hours and then I'll go back and look at it. Because one of the things that's true of this internet world we live in is that if there's a problem, someone else who's a lot smarter than me will find it and post something about it. And then if I just wait 24 hours and then look again, they'll have it all figured out, right? They will have sorted out what's wrong. The smartest thing I can do, given the premise that I'm not smart enough to find and fix the problem, which most of the time I'm not, if I notice something that looks a little hinky, my best strategy is just stop and don't proceed any further and wait and see if anybody else does anything. So you get up in the morning and you look and everything's the same as it was. Nobody else did anything. Nobody else got excited. Okay, there's probably nothing wrong and I probably did something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I should at that point go back. What I would have assumed is that I made a mistake in the download. There's probably something screwed up. And so I'll download it again, because I probably did something wrong. That's why I would have checked to see that there was some error or something, and so I would have downloaded again and then checked, and I would expect then that the MD5 is going to be the same, and I just wouldn't have told anybody I did it because it's a goofy thing, right? In this case, he waits and finds out, oh, yeah, there was a problem. So smart thing to do. Kudos on you, James, and that's what I would suggest other people do if you get yourself into that situation. All right, what do we got for websites? Well, we got to do Void Linux website, so we'll put that up there for everybody to go look at. The interesting thing, when I stuck, no, that was the other one. Never mind. Okay, so you had one up here as well so that I wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So recently at work, I've been using Windows a bit more. And one of the things that Windows has that Linux does not is Notepad++. And this is usually, it's one of the things that I remember when I first started goofing with Linux, I immediately went look for because I love Notepad++. It's pretty, it's a really good tool, very, very slimmed down, but gets the job done. And it's really helpful. I use it almost every day at my job because now I'm doing more Windows stuff. And I just want to tell people that what I did find, though, for a good replacement for Linux concerning Notepad++ is Sublime Text. And it can, you can also rig up Sublime Text to not only, I believe it can compile code and also run code, give or take certain languages. So I was able to use it almost strictly as a Java IDE, and it makes it way more lightweight than Eclipse or IntelliJ or NetBeans is. Now, Rob brought up a great point to me, which I totally forgot about, is that there is a license concerning Sublime Text that they ask you to purchase. Now, I told him I forgot about that because I've been using Sublime Text for what feels like forever now. I have never purchased this license. Now, I know I could do that if I wanted to be, you know, thankful to the project, but I think you can use, I think that's right, Rob. You can't, you, I believe you can use this without purchasing, I can't say the word, buying a license.
Well, on the website, it says that to I should quote it exactly. It says Sublime Text may be downloaded and evaluated for free. However, a license must be purchased for continued use. So, and the thing is that they don't. There's no time limit enforcement. So, you know, you can download it, you can use it for, you can evaluate it for as long as you want. Once you're done evaluating it, they expect that you will buy a license. That you're going to, if you're going to continue to use it, there's the, what their intention in offering it is that you're going to buy, you're going to pay for it.
Oh, gotcha.
So that's their, the premise. Yeah, on the downloaded site, it says, can be downloaded and evaluated for free. However, a license must be purchased for continued use. There's currently no enforced time limit for the license. I wanted to go somewhere in here. I saw what the license was.
I believe it's like $70, I feel like, for a lifetime license.
It's $70 to buy it, but the EULA, there's a software EULA, an end user license agreement that goes with this.
Okay.
That appears to be their own EULA. It looks like it's, you know, it's just a, it's a software license, except that it's much shorter. So this is not GPL software. It's not open source, and it's not free software. It's what, in back in the olden days, we used to call shareware or trialware, or it's not shareware. It's it's something that you can download it and look at it, try it out for free, and it has some. Some really interesting characteristics. It looks like a nice text editor. So,
yeah, I highly recommend it to any of our listeners that have been searching for a replacement for Notepad++. This is definitely high on the list. It could do a lot more than like LeafPad, or Notepad, any of that stuff. It could do a whole lot more. Is baked inside of it. You just got to configure it a little bit, but it's very powerful.
So I have not gone looking for a... I use Notepad++ on Windows as well when I'm over there instead of using Notepad. And I've not gone looking for something on Linux because what I've found that for the editing that I do, either Nano or Gedit seem to meet all my needs. And including, limited program development. Neither of them are particularly good for that. But then I'll often drop into something like Genie or, you know, an IDE like that if I'm going to do any kind of program development for any length of time. And so I don't really have a need for a programmer's text editor, a programmer's editor on really anywhere.
It's pretty good for JavaScript files. I've found Atom is another one that floats out there in the wild. It's good for that stuff. But I agree with you, Rob. There's a lot of viable alternatives. This is one of those that I remember a buddy turned me on to. Yeah. I didn't use it as much. Then slowly I found myself, much like the searchable menu in Cinnamon, slowly I found myself going to it more and more.
You just get
and not
used
even made
to
it. Yep, exactly.
Yep. True enough. So I ran into this. So we got a tip here. And I ran into this problem. And anybody who's got Chrome on Linux, Chrome on 32-bit Linux, is going to run into this probably. You start to get this error that pops up that says it won't update, it can't find the repo or it can't find something or other. And what's happening is that Chrome has dropped 32-bit support. And so they just aren't doing it anymore. And so there's a fairly simple fix that's we'll put the two links in the show notes as to where these things are. You just go in and change your software sources. If you're using Chrome on, and this doesn't affect Chromium, but if you're using Chrome on Linux, Google Chrome, then you can go in and just change you'll have a PPA, an extra source in there for the Chrome, and you just change that to point at an AMD 64 download instead of the 32-bit one, and that fixes it. So I was glad to see that up there.
Now, here, a little bit of a disclaimer on this. I'm still somewhat getting the problem on, it goes away, it's like intermittent. It goes away, comes back, and I'm not for sure what the issue is. I'm not sure if the UI updater Mint's not correctly picking up an idea, but I was going to ask you, Rob, since you tried it, see if it's working for you. It seems to be working for me 1 minute, and next minute it's right back to square one. I'm very confused on that. So if any of our listeners I'm equally in that same boat, because I put this tip on there, and I was like, this is really good, and it worked, and suddenly one day last week it stopped working and worked, and that's when it began the off and on switching.
So I wonder if it depends on where you make the change. I don't know what the right answer is, because I've had to do this a couple of times now on different boxes that have Chrome on them. If you go through the software, through the source or the software sources in the Mint updater, and you change the URL in there, that may stay longer, maybe. Maybe if you go in, if you follow the actual fix that's on OMG Ubuntu, then Mint may write over top of it.
Oh, okay.
Whereas if you go into the update manager, edit software sources, additional repositories, select Google, edit the URL, then go back up to the beginning of the URL, and you put in square bracket arch ARCH equals AMD 64 close square bracket right ahead of the it's right after deb and ahead of the URL, I think, and then it works. So anyway, the other one that I was going to post up in here was recording terminal activity. We've talked about screen recorders in the past, you can record a sequence of screens and stuff on a GUI. But this is a way of you just go to a terminal command and type in script, S-C-R-I-P-T. And it says, okay, I've started. And then you do a bunch of stuff in the console. And then you type exit. And it writes something called terminfo.cap, terminfo.cap or termcap or something. It writes a file, anyway, a text file in your documents directory that contains all of the commands you typed and all of the console output that came out as well. It basically kind of tees whatever it is you're doing, and that's it. It all comes out in a big long stream. So it's an interesting little gadget for if you're tracking sort of something that you've been doing and you're working on, and you want to remember kind of what all the output was. Now the problem is if you've got fancy or ANSI fonts and colors and all that kind of stuff, those all come through as the ANSI sequences, which is less useful. It's best with a plain vanilla, ordinary console that's got just a normal text command or text prompt and the whole thing. That works actually a lot better. But anyway, I thought it was an interesting sort of little thing that...
That's a super cool tip there.
It's the kind of thing that you can do if you're... You know, you either need it today or nobody's going to care about it.
So. Oh, I just sent this to a buddy of mine on Hangouts. So I was like, hey, check this thing out. This is really cool. So yeah, I like it. Thing.
It's not like the steam engine going across your screen, but it's one of those kind of things.
it's not cow powers, but it is.
It's not cow powers, right. okay, so some announcements. So I got something. I want to jump in with my Texas Linux Fest announcement. It's coming July 8th and 9th in Austin, Texas. And so the call for papers is open. If you just go to 2016.texaslinuxfest.org, I think.
Rob, are you going to be at that one?
I am absolutely going to be at that one, as long as I'm allowed.
Are you going to give a talk?
I can't think of anything interesting to talk about.
Void Linux? What are you talking about?
Oh, Void Linux. Yeah, I could talk about Void Linux. Yeah. No, I put in a call for... I responded to the call for papers once, but they didn't pick it up, so...
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Cool.
And now I've forgotten. So, Foss Talk Live. This is... What is this about? Oh, this is in here because the Luddites are... Yeah,
oh, no, okay. Well, it's not just them. So, apparently, co-host and friend of the show, Joe Ressington, he has put together something called Foss Talk Live, free evening of live Linux podcast, which will take place on Saturday, the 6th of August, 2016, in London. There will be live recording shows of Linux Voice, Ubuntu Podcast, and the Linux Luddites. I am... extremely jealous of anyone who gets to go to this, because I believe there's only 60 tickets. I'm not for sure on how many there is, and I have a feeling because these are going to sell out really quick. I highly recommend, if you're going to be in the area, to go check this out. It will be a special drunken mashup show. would be the best way to... And it was featuring other people, but I feel like they're all just going to be a really, really good show, drunken mashup of all of them. They're all great podcasts. Seeing them live would be even better. So I highly encourage everybody to go grab their ticket now.
Yep, Linux Voice. So we got Stuart Langridge, Dave Mega Slippers, and Joe Ressington. They're a wild bunch of people. Yeah, so you're going to be in there. And then, of course, we'll put a post into a list of conferences according to the Linux Foundation. And I think your comment's right on there, Isaac. You know, get in ahead and look at these things.
Yeah, we have listeners from all over the world, and sometimes if you plan on attending a conference, especially through your work and having them pay for it, they're going to want that paperwork done several months in advance. I've been down that road. So give or take your area, here's a list of all the conferences that the Linux Foundation has dubbed pretty big time. So check them out, make your work pay for them, turn the paperwork in, attend. It's worth it, especially if you're not paying for it.
Indeed. I think that's going to bring us to the end. We're running a little later than normally, but not too bad.
No, not too bad.
So some acknowledgments to close us out. Thanks to Kay Wisher for the PiCaster, although, you know, the guys on the IRC have been just grumbling for a lot of this. There's something going on with the PiCaster. I think it's got indigestion. There's some quantum mechanical effect happening. I guess the stream's been coming up and down, and it looks really quiet from our end, but I think there's been something odd going on the PiCaster. But we do appreciate its existence in any case, and I know Kay Wisher will be right all over that. The Mumble server's been absolutely flawless again, so thank you to John Neustetter for that. And, of course, thank you to the Linux Mint gang for all that they do. So I think that's going to be it for me. We'll be live again in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. Yep. We might even look at another Linux distro.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, could be. All right. Well, we will we'll see you guys in a couple of weeks then.
Yep, take care.
This has been another episode of Mintcast. The show notes for this episode are at www.mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org or leave voicemail at +1-832-514-2278. That's 832-514-CAST. You can find more information on Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter at Mintcast and at Linux_Mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco and Oscar for the podcast music, and thanks for listening to this episode of Mintcast.